We're just announcing, just for the sake of the tape. You can keep talking, but for the sake of the tape, we're announcing what this year's about.
This is Rabbi Liebtag, March 23rd, 2008, and the topic
is... The Jewish date. Shushan Purim in Yerushalayim, Tet Zayin, Adar Bet, Tavshin, Samech Chet. Okay. One day they might forget the Jewish date, they won't know what's
happening. And the topic is Achashverosh in Megillas Esther and Achashverosh in Ezra.
Okay
so...
we get ready to start. Hopefully everyone, you promised me to talk today. That's why, thanks to Terry, we have a whole collection of them. He brought that the kind I like.
If it's not a Koran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it'll help me in the share, because if you look at the beginning of Megillat Esther,
we'll be okay.
If I need it, I'll call you. Just a couple extras there. Yeah. If anyone needs, like, if there's an English Koran here, anyone needs? And there's a couple. Do you guys have in the back? Yep.
And I also have everything on a source sheet.
No,
have source sheets in the middle. Actually, this one I can give out now. You don't have the sources we're going to do at Ezra are all in this one. It's like really cryptic, but... The main stream we're quoting in Ezra is going to be in the source sheet. But if you take a look in this snap that Terry brought, I forget who told this. It came out very recently. What they did helped the reader, and this is always a problem. The second you put anything inside of a Tanakh, the student doesn't know what's authentic and what's not. If you have just Tanakh, Nikud is fine, because that's Nesoret. The second you put dates, Pirushim, translations, something like that, that's already commentary. But when the student's learning from the copy, he sees all these dates on the side, it sounds to the student authoritative.
And that's what we have to talk about when we put it on.
I'd rather you not use the sheet. Okay. That's in case you don't have a Tanakh, in case you don't want to take notes with the sources I'm recording, that's just a backup. I brought that as a backup in case people didn't have Tanakh in. So we're going to start? Again, the problem is when you have dates, they sound authoritative. Now look at the date in the beginning of Megillat Esther. They have dates, what's called the Briat Olam. The date is still creation. What date is there? 3395. That's what? BCE, AD,
where are you reading?
The first beginning of Book of Esther. This is not the most that you have.
That one.
Yeah. Has dates in it. And there it says year 3395, and they're using dates to Briat Olam. Now it's interesting, and that's why I begin. Let me explain where I want to go with this year. This year required 5 hours easily. I'm only going to take one little unit of it and try to get one point across because we only have an hour. And hopefully I'll get you angry at me that we'll want to continue one day. This is one of the most difficult topics that any student finishing yeshiva or growing up in the yeshiva world, when he goes to university, has so much trouble with this topic. Because when you study in yeshiva, and you follow any art scroll history, or even during the second Rosh Hashanah, and you ask how many years was the second temple period, like you know by heart, anyone who learned in yeshiva, how many years was the first Beit HaMikdash?
410.
The first Beit HaMikdash? 410. Second Beit HaMikdash?
420.
Ask anybody, it's automatic. They all say 420. But the same student asks them, what year was the first Beit HaMikdash destroyed? In Galatian dates, what do they tell you right away? Everyone says 586.
Right.
This is 586.
Right.
And what year was the second Beit HaMikdash destroyed?
70.
Now, take off 70 years between the first and the second. So how many years was the second temple? About 585 or something.
560.
The years that everyone knows by heart. The same people tell you 410, 420. In the same breath will tell you minus 586 or minus 516 to plus 70, which is 585 years. If you've ever seen that little series called Me Brishit that they put out on Shabbat, Matthew Lund's thing that puts out a balloon, that thing for kids. Mm-hmm. They have a double timeline on the bottom. They have timeline of Jewish history and outside history. On the same page, I talked to Nachum Amstel about it. I was the first person to notice what he did. It's two timelines. One with the Jewish dates, the Briat Olam. The other, which has 420, from the second Beit HaMikdash. The ones with the Goyish dates has pretty much the 580 years. Now, how did he do it? The scale every year on one is different than the scale. He had to play with the scale limit so they match up. And that's why nothing's really exact on there. What's the problem? When you go to university and you study outside history, it's clear to anybody that the Second Temple period was way more than 420 years. I mean, it fits so nicely, without the code explaining why. It's accepted in almost all the universities, and the people who came up with it, with the outside history, with the 500 years of Vaishnavi, aren't doing it to uproot the Bible or anything. They're just doing it on a regular study. There's plenty of things they do all the hakis, but there's things, there's no reason for them to do that hakis. What we want to try and explain today is, why did Sefer Olam reach the conclusion of 420? And what the goal, which I want to show you is, the conclusion of 420 is not tradition, it's exegesis. And that's going to solve the biggest problem. Let me explain, I'll go over the problem again. If you come believing in Chazal, and you believe everything they say and holding, etc., etc., and then the Gemara tells you the high chain was 420 years, and then you go to any college and you see, you're convinced it's not 420, it's 580 something, say, oh, and you're convinced the rabbis made a mistake in the history, then if they made a mistake in history, they did a mistake also in Halakha, and little by little, maybe even not little by little, you start losing everything. It happens to college kids all the time. So there's two approaches to that. One is to insulate, which means don't go to college, or don't take those courses in college, or say, you know, they're trying to lie to you. And you have to accept everything the rabbis say, and that's it, and that's your challenge of being Jewish. Or to try to teach them how to, without apologetics, how to explain what happened. So the goal of this year is to explain what happened. And I think we can do it. What I want to show you is that there's no contradiction at all between Tanakh and outside history. That's the opposite. The Tanakh and outside history fits beautifully. We have to understand why Chazal crushed the history and took away 160 years. We're going to try and show what happened and why that happened. And the goal of the shir is to convince you that when Chazal say 420, it's parshanut. It's exegesis, and it's not tradition. In the text, it's not that, oh, here's what we learned. This is a tradition. This is how many years my Shady was. The conclusion is the second step was 420 years was an exercise in parshanut, which has also thematic meaning. Because it's going to follow the theme of the Bible, what I call, I have a new line I use. It said if there's Shutosha Mikram, Shutosha Torah. Sometimes Chazal explain things, Shutosha Mikra is the simple meaning of the text. Sometimes they don't explain Shutosha Mikra because they're worried about Shutosha Torah. I'll give you an example from Pesach. When it says, Babur Zeh Hashem Lid, the Ketz of the Bichav Yom Lelemor, Babur Zeh Hashem Lid, B'Tech Mim Yitzrayim. Shutosha Mikra is, you tell your children, that I'm eating matzah because that reminds us how God took me out of Egypt. Rashi comes and says, we tell our children that God took us out of Egypt so that we would eat matzah. Which sounds really strange in the Pesach. So Rashi takes Shutosha Torah, because when he follows the Imam Chumash, God put us into Egypt and took us out so that we would eat matzah and keep his mitzvot. Except Rashi, Shutosha Torah, even though it's not Shutosha Mikra. But Chumash is ambiguous enough to write it in a way that it will take Rashi and Ramah. Again, that's a topic in personal. What we have to do to start today is try to, and this is a difficult part, and I got lots of pages to give out, and if I give them out to you now, you'd be totally confused. I want to make sure we're holding on the same page. We just read Megillah a day or two ago. And it starts with Ahidim Yachashverosh. That's the only real historical pasuk in the beginning, which seems to be that the book is being written after the event, not as they're happening. It's not a diary of the event. It's being written in prophetic in historic hindsight, maybe a generation or two later, because you have to identify who was this Ahasuerus. From what you remember, is this Ahasuerus Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek? How do we know he's Persian? He's a Persian king. He's Molech Mihodu Akush, which is from Ethiopia to India. And there's only two Persian kings who actually achieved that. There was Darius the Great and Xerxes. We'll go over the years later on who they are. But that's the Ahasuerus of the Megillah. He's a Persian king. Have you heard of any other Persian kings from the back of your, from your collective memory? What other Persian kings have you heard of? Cyrus, better known as Koresh the Great. And any other ones you've heard of? Artaxerxes. Diana, you've heard of? And Artaxerxes. Those are the ones that are mentioned over and over again in Zohar. Again, there's Koresh, Achashverosh, Daryavesh, Artashavta. I want to make sure all those things ring a bell. No. Of all those, who is the first Persian king beyond a shadow of a doubt? Who has to be the first Persian king?
Koresh.
It's got to be Koresh because it says so. First, Koresh is identified as the king who takes over the Babylonian Empire. So maybe there's another king, the king of Med, Daryavesh HaMadid. He popped up there for a year. And Daniel, I don't want to complicate it. But the classic three Persian kings are Koresh. Koresh is the first. And then we have Achashverosh and Daryavesh HaTashavta. Then the question is, who comes in between? Where are they? So what do you remember learning? What was the order? Who was after Koresh? Chazal put Achashverosh after Koresh, which is interesting. It doesn't say that anywhere, but Chazal put it there, because who comes after Achashverosh? Daryavesh. And what did Daryavesh allow the Jews to do in the second year of his reign? To build the temple. That everyone knows. That's Chagai, that's Chariah, that's written. And the question is, why the change of mind? Why the change? Why all of a sudden are now the Jews allowed to build the Mikdash in the time of Daryavesh? What must have happened? And Esther must be
the mother.
And therefore, and Darius now claims that he's only 5 or 6 years old. And therefore, Mordechai and Esther are running the kingdom. And when Darius says it's okay to build the temple, it's really a decision of Mordechai and Esther, and everything makes sense. If you think that makes sense. But it works out really great. So now we have the order. Koresh. Achashverosh. Followed by Daryavesh. And then what do we do with Artashasta? So if Chazal come and say, that's the same as what everyone calls, they say Daryavesh and Artashasta is the same character, the same king. Even though that doesn't fit into Tanakh at all, as we're going to see today. But the conclusion of Chazal is as follows. In Seder Olam, if we have time, I'm going to give you Seder Olam to take a look at inside. Seder Olam, you've heard of Seder Olam? What was Seder Olam written? Seder Olam is Miuchat to Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta. Some Rabbi Yossi is Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta. He was in Kippurim, about 2nd, 3rd century. He was the generation before Rabbi. The generation after Rabbi Akiva, before Rabbi, pretty much. What's that? Like 280, 200 something?
Yeah.
Which means it's late Tanayim, after Korban Beit HaMikdash, and Seder Olam is an attempt, a valiant attempt, by Tanayim, to go back and figure out the calendar of Jewish history based on Tanakh. Which is what, there's nothing wrong with that. But what's interesting, when you study Tanakh, never ever is there ever a date in the entire Tanakh, there's never an event that's dated to Briat Olam. What do we date events to in Tanakh? Either the king, and every once in a while he set me trying. That's it. In the desert, we're counting the set me trying, the 40 years, and then when the Beit HaMikdash is built, we count the set me trying. To the Exodus. And otherwise we date to kings. But there's never a date to Briat Olam. More than that, in the time of the Tanaim, in the time of Mishnah and Gemara, never is a star ever dated to Briat Olam. If they had a wedding back then, and they wrote a ksuba, it didn't say on there a date to Briat Olam. What date do they use? Chazal called Minyan Shtarot. You've heard of Minyan Shtarot? Minyan Shtarot, it's called Minyan Shtarot. That's the counting they use for Shtarot. What days is it that they use for Minyan Shtarot? They didn't make their own. They use the Goyish, the same thing we do say when we write checks. They use the Goyish today. What was the Goyish today back then before there were our kind of Goyim? They used the Greek counting system called Minyan Yevanim. Or I think it's called the Seleucid calendar. In the Greek Empire, in the Hellenist world, Alexander the Great began and conquered, they had a convention to count the years, and the correlating figure is year one of Minyan Shtarot is minus 312 BCE, or minus 312, the 312 BCE, I don't need the minus there, it's a double negative. 312 BCE is the beginning, 312 years before the Yashka count started, which according to them was he was born at minus 4, okay, you know that. That's a history, excuse me. But that's the counting system. So let me summarize my first point. In Jewish sources, Tanakh, Gemara, Mishnah, etc., no, there's never an event counted to Briat Olam. When did the custom of counting to creation begin, pretty much? It began in Europe, about 10th to 11th century, for a very good reason. Because during the time of the Tanaim and Amorim and Babel, etc., we used the Greek, which later became the Roman, counting system, which was accepted over that whole. the whole Middle East and Near East, the whole area over there. When the Jews moved from Pumbedit, from Persia, and they moved to Europe, first to North Africa, then to Europe, they became under the influence of the Christian Church. And all of a sudden in Europe, they're using a different counting system, which is, it'll be right in our checks today. Using Binyan Sherot never bothered anybody. That's fine. But writing what they call AD, which is the year of their Lord, a Jew couldn't put that. So we don't have that. We're used to that. It's no big deal. But back then they couldn't do that. And therefore they needed a Jewish way of counting. They began a beautiful minhag of counting to Briyat HaOlam, which is totally legitimate. But they didn't have any scientists and they didn't have any way to figure out how many years it's been since Briyat HaOlam. What did they decide to use for the calculation? Somebody did the work for them. They took a brisa called Seder Olam, written by Rabbi Yosef Bar Chalasa, which is beautiful, but Parshanut, it's exegesis, and they used that as a standard for counting to Briyat HaOlam. And from that time till today, last 1,000 years, everyone uses it in the Jewish world. And we grew up with it, what's this, 5768? What people don't realize is that year 5768 is based on the assumption that there were 420 years to Bayit Sheni. To the second, we're going to see that very soon. But if we don't hold it, if we hold it, Bayit Sheni wasn't 420, it was longer, then you would be much, closer to the year 6000. Yeah. Which would be an amazing coincidence if you were so close that it was something catastrophic or something that would be nice.
That would be
nice. Which is the normal time period. Nothing major is happening. What I want to do now, but probably the only thing I'm going to accomplish today, is we're going to go through the book of Ezra, and we're going to try and understand why is it that it's so difficult to figure out the chronology. What I want to show you is the author of the book of Ezra Nehemiah, which is our main source, the author of the book of Ezra Nehemiah, makes no attempt to give the reader continuous chronology. I'm going to bring an example to explain what I mean. If you read Sefer Melachim, the author of Sefer Melachim gives the reader the ability to figure out in a continuous chronology, doesn't he? Anyone who's read Sefer Melachim realizes that right away. Yirmiyahu, when he authors Sefer Melachim, wants the reader to be able to chart the years from the beginning of Shlomo to Korban HaBayit. How does he do it? Every time he introduces the king, and the year of this king, that king, etc. And you have all the years of the kings of Yehuda, but from the time that Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash, which is like, I think, the seventh year of his reign, where he begins in the beginning of his reign, from the time Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash until the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed in the 11th year of TPL, you count up all the years of all the kings, you know how much you get? Try it one time.
No,
you get 428. So why did the rabbi say 410? Because the first year of every king, of every new king, is the last year of the previous king. Because the years notch up. Not up, there's a fancy word. Not overlap. Increment. That's a good word. The year increment? No. The year of the king increment. I think that's the right word.
I think overlap.
Overlap?
No. If the king becomes king in Adar, if there's a king who became king today, yeah. A month from now, Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the second year of his reign.
They round up.
The year of the king increments every Rosh Chodesh Nisan, not on his birthday, and not on his coronation day. The year increments, so therefore, a king could be king for 3 days to be the second year of his reign. If he's coronated in Adar, Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the second year of his reign. That's the mission of Rosh Chodesh. You count the years of the king that way, not everyone can remember every coronation ceremony and every birthday. So we increment the years of the king, and therefore, the last year of Pithiel is the first year of Menasheh. Is that it? And therefore, for every change in kings, there's 19 kings, for every change in kings, they have to take off the year. But therefore, that's how you get 410 years of Bayit Rishon. It's that simple. Now, what's going to happen in the book of Ezra is as follows. Here, I'm going to give out the first sheet now to clarify what we just did. That's just around.
Test these this way and that way. Test that out that way. And do that this way. 30. Share every one or two.
Don't look at the top part yet. Look at the bottom part. What I call calculations of Seder Olam. Seder Olam does a calculation here of how many years there are through the destruction of the Second Temple. Now, Chazal had a Masoret that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in year 380 of Minyan Sherot. Understand? I mean, 380 years after Minestro begins when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Which means still 380 years since Alexander the Great. Is that clear? Now, based on that, here's the calculation, which is so simple. Based on Chumash, these are the years that Sederon does, and they're so easy to figure out. From creation to the birth of Avraham Avinu was 1948. Everyone knows that? That's based on the genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 11 in Bereshit. We have all the years. And it just comes out that he was born in 1948. What I like to call, and touching my joke on that one? No. That, just could be that Torah Minayin. You understand? It's a pew. It's easy way to remember, but it's safe. Now, if you're Zionist, then it's a... For the birth of Yitzhak, for the birth of Avram, so the birth of Yitzhak is 100 years old, is 100 years, based on a pasuk we read on Rosh Hashanah, Avram, and Ma'ashanah, because I don't like Yitzhak, we don't know that one by heart. Correct? For the birth of Yitzhak, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the minimum opinion, according to the Brit Mitzrayim, is 400 years. So that's what they put down, and therefore the famous day we came out of Egypt, 2448. Then there's a pasuk in Malachim Aleph, Perek Vav, when Shlomo built the Beit HaMikdash. It says, it's been 400 years since Am Yisrael came out of Egypt, and that year Shlomo built the house for God. Nice round number, 480. And therefore the first Beit HaMikdash is built 2928. Between the building, disruption, between, I'm sorry, the first Beit HaMikdash lasted 410, I explained that to you already. You follow the years?
Mm-hmm.
After the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, until the second one was built, is how many years? Based on, what's everyone going to say it's based on?
You know,
and that's a big mistake everybody makes, which is a totally separate, I think I did that show once before. That's a totally different shita. It's not a prediction, it's not a prophecy. It's a statement made by the Navi Zechariah. Zechariah Perek Aleph, but they get bet. They broke ground, they're breaking ground on the second temple in the second year of Dayavish. Recha Gain Zechariah. That's the Hanukkah show. Breaking ground. And he's hoping it's going to work. And Zechariah says, in this Nebuah, the Malach says to God, Ad Matai Lot Rachim Al Yehuda, Yerushalayim, Asher Zahamte Zeh Shivin Shana. It's been 70 years since the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. When are you going to have Rachmanis on it and let this get off the ground? So Zechariah is making a statement. And the second year of Dayavish is in 70 years since the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. It's not a prophecy, it's nothing. It's a statement. And that's what Seder Olam does, not going, I'm simply following Seder Olam. And therefore, the second Beit HaMikdash is built in 3308. That'd be 3408. Got it? Yeah. The big leap of faith that Seder Olam does, he claims that the entire second temple period was 34 years under Persian rule. Got that? From the second year of Dayavish until Alexander the Great comes in, until Alexander the Great kills Darius the Third, killed Dayavish. Everyone knows that Alexander the Great killed that Dayavish, Darius. Now, in history, Darius the Third. Chazal thinks that all the same Darius, who was also Artashasta. And Chazal crunched some 180 years of Persian history into 34 years. We're going to explain why they do that. That's the big jump they make. They give 34 years under Persian rule. The base they have one Persian king. It's based on Suki Netanyahu, which we'll have time hopefully to talk about later on. And then the biggest leap of faith that Seder Olam does, which is needed, is they give 6 years to Alexander the Great until Minyan Shor begins. Because according to Chazal, what year does Minyan Shor begin? Take a look. 3448. Which is the key pretty much to the whole what's going on. Isn't it an amazing coincidence that Minyan Shor begins according to Seder Olam in what year? 1K. 1K from what?
1,000 years after.
It's exactly 1,000 years after Yitzhak Mitzrayim. That could be an amazing coincidence, or it could be on purpose. Because what seems to have happened is, Seder Olam has an agenda. He has several agendas. One agenda is to turn a Goyish state into a Jewish state. And he does a tremendous job. Because what, in the time of Seder Olam, what dating system are all the rabbis using? Minyan Shorot is a Greek system. It's a Goyish system they're using. One of the accomplishments of Seder Olam is to turn the Goyish system into a Jewish state, and to do that, what do you need to do? The same thing we do, add 1K in front. Remember we do, when we say Tashin Samachet, we're assuming another 5,000 in front. In the time of Seder Olam, we're only in the hundreds. Seder Olam, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalas is living in about the year 5-600 to Minyan Shor. Korban Levi is 380, and they're about 200 years later. So between 550 and 600. And therefore, if I add 1K, it's 1,560. And what is the accomplishment of Seder Olam is to turn Minyan Shtarot into a Jewish state? Now, what's wrong with that? That's tremendous, isn't it?
That doesn't affect that he knows it's wrong.
Yeah, for sure. What's wrong with that? Well, why does he have to treat history like we do? What? Why is our Tfisa of history, why does it have to be projected back out there 2,000 years back? Especially if everyone around knows what the real history was. I'll give you an example. Josephus was Jewish. A kohen in the Beit HaMikdash. Was living how many years before Seder Olam? Josephus. Josephus is the time of the Korban. 110 years beforehand. Read Josephus' history of the Jews. He's got all the Persian years there. He's got hundreds of years. He's got not exactly like the outside history, but very similar. He's got lots of years there. Which means 100 years before Rabbi Yosef Bar-Halafta, they knew about the length of the Persian time period. Plus they had the book of Ezra Nehemiah, which we'll see, also supports it. There's more than that. When everyone knows, when Chazal make a statement, which is so obviously wrong historically, that everyone knows they're not lying. What are they doing? They're exaggerating on purpose. I'll give you an example. You read the Megillah, and it says in the Megillah, Mekelim Mekelim Shonim. You read it like Eichah. What's the Midrash everyone quotes about Mekelim Mekelim Shonim? Mekelim is the Beit HaMikdash that he's using. If you, just for the fun of it, look in the book of Ezra, the first pasuk in Ezra. It's on your source sheet also. In the book of Ezra, Perek Aleph, pasuk Zion. Yeah, the book of Ezra. It says it twice in the book of Ezra. Remember, in the first line of Ezra, that's the first year of Koresh, is when Yirmiyahu is 7 years or older. Which began in year 4 of Yehoyakim, that was a whole different year. Because that's when everyone gets up here. So do you know that or... I'm not going to get dragged into that. What you said 70 years.
What's the Perek Aleph plus the same?
The very beginning of Ezra. The first year of Koresh is 70 years. The 7 years are over. At that, Koresh gives this big decree. The Balfour Declaration. That all the Jews can go and return to the land of Israel and go to the house for God. And anyone who doesn't go, that's money. I'm sure you've seen those speaking before. But right afterwards, after they go and they cross the Zion, it says, V'melech Koresh hotit klei Beit Hashem, asher hotit nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim, b'tem b'Beit Elohav. Do you think Koresh v'nach for us, I did mitzvah t'gibar, y'tzvim v'shem t'kutar n'asim v'yehuda. He takes all the kingdom of the Beit HaMikdash, that Nebuchadnezzar are taken and put into his treasury. Koresh takes them out of that treasury and gives them to the Jews to return and build the Beit HaMikdash. And he even talks about it in the Cyrus Cylinder. It's written in stone that they found over 100 years ago. They found a Cyrus Cylinder that talks about all the nations having the right to go back and build their temple. That was Persian policy. When the rabbis come in to say that the kelim that they're eating, the suduim, or the kelim to mikdash, when they make that statement, they assume the reader knows Ezra. You know why they assume that? Why would they assume that? Why? Because everyone knows the book of Ezra. If everyone knows the book of Ezra, and they know the kelim came back, and they say what happened, and they know the story in the Megillah after that time period, what do they really say? They're not saying that's right. They're not saying that they're being punished because they took on a misdemeanor. A very confusing, a big enough taking clay to make them gush. They're acting like Chazal again and making a shkach in a roundabout way. So, talking to people who know the book of Ezra, who know the kelim are bad, when they say, what are the Jews doing wrong? They're using the kelim to make them gush at that party. What are they really saying? They're being punished because they didn't go back to Israel when they should have. Which is an underlying theme, that's a Megillah share. That's what we get into. But that's an example when the rabbis make a statement, which is so obviously not historically true, assuming that the readers know enough, then when you notice such an exaggeration, then the question you have to ask yourself is, what are they really up to? And that's why I want to do the same thing with Seder Olam. I want to show you what Seder Olam says when he crunches the years, even a casual reader of Tanakh, who knows what's going on, knows it's not meant to be taken seriously. It's obviously not to be taken seriously, literally, but it's written to be taken thematically. And that's what I'm going to prove to you today. We're going to go through now Ezra and Nehemiah and show you how they crunch the ears and why they crunch the ears. But the author of Ezra and Nehemiah, unlike the author of Sefer Melachim, makes every attempt not to give you continuous chronology. Because what's going to happen? The book of Ezra and Nehemiah begins with the first year of Koresh. We just read that. It's going to jump from the first year, from the second year of Koresh, it's going to jump to the first year of to the early years of Dayanish. It's going to jump. And it's not going to tell you how many years Koresh was king for. It never tells you how many years Dayanus was king for. Never tells you who the king was in between. If I follow the history, you can do it on your own one time. If you're stuck in a talking or stuck in some speech or in a webinar, you're bored one time. Go through the book. It's not that hard. It'll take you maybe an hour. Go through the whole book and go through it If you see, it talks about the first year and second year of Korach, and the next event is Dayadish. And from year 2 to year 6 of Dayadish, it talks about how to build the Beit HaMikdash. We're going to see, it talks about the building the Beit HaMikdash in year 6 of Dayadish. And the next event is going to be year 7 of our Tashasta. What doesn't it tell you? It doesn't tell you how many years Dayadish was king for. It doesn't tell you if there were any kings in between, between Dayadish and Tashasta. And then how many years our Tashasta was king for. You follow with me? When you read the book of Ezra Nehemiah by itself, but it purposely doesn't give you any ability to build a continuous chronology. Instead, it skips from the beginning. It talks about the time of Koresh, 6 years under the reign of Dayadish, and from year 7 to 32 or 34 of Artashasta. And that's all it talks about. And there's a good reason. Because the book of Ezra Nehemiah is a continuation of an earlier book. Now, what's the continuation of? What book does Ezra Nehemiah continue? How do we know that?
Same
thing. The last two lines of Divrei Hayamim are the first two lines of Ezra Nehemiah. And it continues. It's written the same time period. They're all written in the second temple period by Sheikh Hasan Abdullah. Now, if you read Divrei Hayamim, we may have shared before, Divrei Hayamim has an agenda, and the agenda isn't to teach you history, and the agenda isn't to teach you chronicles. The agenda of Divrei Hayamim is to trace the history of how, after we get the genealogy, correct, because there's a big question, who's a Jew at the beginning of Beit Sheni? So we get the genealogies up until the Second Temple period. When we start the story, good, of Divrei Aleph, we're focusing on one primary topic, and that is all the efforts that the Jewish people do to build the Beit HaMikdash, primarily in the time of David. From Perek Yud through to the end of Divrei Aleph, so chapter 29 of Divrei Aleph, we talk about David. It's not the story of the life of David. We don't hear about David and Bathsheba. We don't hear about David and Goliath. We don't hear David and good things. We have nothing about that. It's one topic. Everything that David HaMelech does to build Yerushalayim and build the Beit HaMikdash. And there's a word there because of the topic of Menucha v'Nachala. It's a topic of David can't build it because they didn't reach Menucha v'Nachala yet. They didn't reach rest from their enemy. So in the context of God telling David you can't build yet because you didn't achieve Menucha v'Nachala, we talked about a couple battles through which they achieved Menucha v'Nachala. But the topic of bringing the Arul and ready to for Tehillim, setting up the Levites, all the Mishmarot, take a look at it one time. After you do, before you do Ezra Nehemiah, you have another hour. Straight it. It's easy. It's all about the Beit HaMikdash. For a very good reason. Because the goal of the author of Divrei Hayamim is to inspire the people of Beit Sheni to do what? Just read the book of Haggai. The prophetic message at the beginning of the Second Temple period is, you guys are lazy. That's the Hanukkah share. And get to work. It's black and white in the book of Haggai. And it's Haggai as well. We need to motivate the people to say, God gave you a window, an opportunity to rebuild your Shabbat Beit HaMikdash. Look what your forefathers did. Look what David HaMelech did. And let him be your inspiration. When I follow the years of the kings of Yehuda, after David, Shlomo, I talk about Shlomo building the Beit HaMikdash, all the good stuff. And if there's going to be a story that's in Divrei Hayamim, that's not in Melachim, it's going to be about the Beit HaMikdash. Uziyahu, for example. Remember when he goes into Makom Torah? That's a Beit HaMikdash story. It's in Divrei Hayamim. Aviyah had this whole big battle. He talks about the Beit HaMikdash. It's in Divrei Hayamim. If you're looking for the differences between Divrei Hayamim and Melachim, things have to do with the connection between the king and the Beit HaMikdash. That's Divrei Hayamim. And therefore, the history there is fun on purpose, because that's the goal of the book. The goal of Chronicles is not to teach you Chronicles. The goal of Chronicles is to inspire the people of Beit Sheni to get to work on the temple. And that explains the differences. If that's true, what's going to be Ezra Nehemiah? Ezra Nehemiah is not going to be the history of the Jewish people during the Persian time period. It's going to be the history of all the efforts done by the Jewish people to build the temple. And what does it focus on? It focuses solely on all the efforts to build up Yerushalayim, to build the Beit HaMikdash. What doesn't it talk about? Anything else. And if there's a time period during Beit Sheni where the Jewish people do nothing about the temple, you know what happens in Ezra Nehemiah? That's it. Nothing. It skips it. On purpose. And that's the main point of my share. And then we have to see it inside. What I want to suggest is as follows. From a thematic point of view, the authors of Ezra Nehemiah, I think that's Azola, are purposely writing the book and skipping any time period where Am Yisrael doesn't do anything about the Beit HaMikdash. Because it's continuing the topic of Divrei Hayamim. And therefore I hear about the first Aliyah in the time of Koresh, when they have to try to build a Beit HaMikdash, and they answer that call, some people do. And so we even announce their name. Ask any shul rabbi or president, or when you start announcing people's names. People donate to the shul, people help. And by announcing their name, hopefully they'll maybe get more or do more. There's all these things in Ezra Nehemiah. What do we need them for? It's publicity. We're encouraging the people to build the Beit HaMikdash. You know, if you get involved, maybe your name will be in the next version. We'll get you into the book. We'll get you into the book. It works. Ask anyone raising money. And you find the whole tax system works that way. Then, after they stop during the time of course, we'll read about it soon, there's a stop in the building, and nothing picks up again until the second year of Dayanish. We skip those years, and then we figure out the second year of Dayanish. We finish doing the sixth year of Dayanish, and then everything settles down. The next time anyone does something about the Beit HaMikdash is the seventh year of Artaxerxes. What does the book do? It skips from your sixth of Dayanish to your seventh of Artaxerxes. Purposely. And that's it. The book ends with the Chevi, and that's it. What does Chazal do? What does Seder Olam do? Seder Olam only counts the years that Sefer Ezra talks about. Understand? What I'm assuming is, if everyone in the time of Seder Olam, in the time of, remember Seder Olam, Gabriel Tiberchat isn't coming up with it on his own. It's Midrashim that's been around, he puts them all together. If during the time of the Tanayim, they're totally aware of how long the first time period was, but they also have the book of Ezra Nehemiah, which has been canonized already, or it's being canonized now. It's being put together. And I want to write, I'm sorry, it's canonized in the middle of my sheni already. We're talking about after the Qurban. In the time of the Tanayim, Sefer Ezra Nehemiah is given already. And when they're making up this Jewish calendar, when they're making Seder Olam, they have a thematical, they have a prophetical. And one goal is, let's keep alive the theme of the book of Ezra. And what's that theme? The only events in Jewish history that count, at least in the beginning of Beit Sheni, are times when the Jewish people took an effort to build Yerushalayim. What does Seder Olam do? It ignores any time period when we didn't do anything to build Yerushalayim. Following the history of the book of Ezra Nehemiah. And therefore, purposely it's kept so dear, even though the people knew the years existed, for a thematic reason, for a prophetic reason, which is totally legitimate. Now, what happens hundreds of years later, that's the difficulty what I'm saying. I'm assuming that hundreds of years later, the original message of that was lost, and they took it literally. Now, they have this stuff all the time. Ask any kid. We take centimeters and we take them literally. It's a classic phenomenon that happens all the time. And there's a good reason for it, but you don't know the real history. So why should you take it literally? And then, only recently, we start putting history back together again, thanks to all the things that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us, archaeology and things like that. And through that, we can better understand what's going on in the Tanakh. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to go through the book of Ezra and try to show you what I'm talking about. We read the opening Sukkim you all know about, time of Koresh. Skip to Perek Dalet. Skip to Perek Dalet in the book of Ezra. I'll add up what's happening in between. We get a list of all the people in the end of Perek Aleph and Perek Bet. Perek Gimel, it's the second year of the time of Koresh. They build a Mizbeah. They want to start to build a Beit HaMikdash. The older people are all depressed. This is nothing. The young people are all excited. And they finally break ground in the second year of Koresh on the second temple after Rosh Hashanah. And then we get into trouble. We get our first Intifada. And Perek Dalet in Ezra. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Aleph. The Vayishmut Sarei Yehuda Binyamin, Kibnei Kolam Borim Hechal Hashem Elei Yisrael. The enemies of Yehuda, when the Jews return at the beginning of Beit Sheni, they're not a majority at all, they're a minority. Who's living in the land of Canaan? All the people that the Assyrians have brought in. And they're worshipping the same, they think they're worshipping the same God. And when these Jews come in from Babel, they want to be part of it. And therefore they say as follows to them. Pasuk Bet. They chose from Babel to Roshei Avot, v'emru lehem, v'ei mechem ki kechem nidrosh lehem. They say, hey, we want to go with you, we want to be part of it. So Babel answers and tells them, remember them through Babel, and he says, we've been here since, Melech Ashur brought us here. Pasuk Gimel, v'emel ezru b'vel shuav v'shar Roshei Avot, lo lachem v'lanu, si dekri uti lanlo et pni. Lo lamed aleph or lo. They meet lamed vav, and they have the right to lamed aleph. It's not ours and yours. Lachem d'knot, v'ayit Hashem, I'm sorry, not that one, the other one. The first one, in Pasuk Bet. Lo anachnu zofkin, I'm sorry about that. Lo anachnu zofkin, isn't that great, in Pasuk Bet? Lo, they meet lamed vav. King T puts in Lamed Aleph. That's like one of the best crew teams in all the night. But then, Pasuk Gimel. So Rabba tells them, Lo lechem elanu b'knot b'ayit Hashem. It's not for both of us, we're going to do it ourselves. What's the response? Pasuk Dalet. Vayi am aretz mrapim yad hidei am Yehuda, uvahalim otam libnot, v'tzachrem elam biwatsim lafer atatam, koi lei koresh mela paras, ad makut ayamash mela paras. Got it?
No.
The Jews want to build. They don't let the local population join them. They start in Yisipara, and they stop the building from the time of Koresh to the time of Dayavish. How many years elapsed in between?
We don't know.
We have no idea. We just jump it. Because what happened? The Jews stopped building. They were scared. They had the right to do it, so they stopped. Later on in the book of the next two chapters, next 2.5 chapters in the book of Ezra, is the story of that Intifada. In fact, it's the story of that lobby. Because there's a letter called Yigat Rahum. That the Persian officials, the local officials in Canaan, write to the Persian officials saying these Jews are building the temple, and if you let them build the temple, they're gonna get these right-wing fanatics, and they're gonna not only build a temple, they're gonna start saying that this is a Jewish state, they're gonna want sovereignty, they wanna build their old army, we have this whole Zionist thing, and they're gonna take over the world and start making matzahs with blood again. If Allah, they're gonna, they're scaring. They write a letter, a scare letter. If you allow the Jews to build the temple, who knows what's going to happen? The people have been right-wing fanatics. No, look what happened in the first temple, because they're always rebelling. They don't take anyone. They don't take anyone sovereign over them. Don't let them build. And they listen. And that story, if you take a look at it, we'll see it in a minute. We'll see it in 1 second. In Pasuk Zayin, that's the jump from Koresh to Dayavish. Pasuk Zayin is really cryptic. I mean, Pasuk Vav, super cryptic. ובמלכות אחשוורוש, בתחילת מלכותו, כתבו סיגנא יושבי יהודה וירושלים. We just said that they stopped the building from when?
From
the second year of Dayavish, I mean from the second year of Koresh to the beginning of Dayavish.
Right.
And then it says during the reign of Achashverosh, in the beginning of his reign, they put a hate letter about the Jews. Now when is this Achashverosh? Before or in between? Or after?
Okay.
Totally unclear. Intentionally unclear. Chazal could have put this Achashverosh in between. In between Koresh and Dayavish.
Right.
That's what Sarulan does. But it needs to be afterwards. But you can't prove anything from here. Other than the fact that the author of the book is leaving it open. Because he doesn't want to give you continuous chronology. We'll try to see why. Then, Vimeret HaShafta, notice here it's two sins, not a Samach and a sin. Ketav Yisham, then we get to Aramaic, and that's the story of the hate letter that is sent to the Persian officials to stop the building, which works. Then finally, when Darius becomes king, they get another letter. The Jews send a letter and say, listen, your predecessor, Koresh, gave us permission, and it's in the official work, and they open up the archives, and they find Darius finds, sure enough, the Jews do have the right to build, and he gives them the right to build. That's the story of Parakeh and Parak Vav. That's over in Parak Vav. Again, it's Aramaic, you can read it later on your own. That's the story of the exchange of letters. But if you look on the page I gave you, about the list of Persian kings, it fits beautifully in between. Because we have Koresh, we have Cambyses as the king in between. If you look up any history book, the order of the Persian kings during this time period, every history book, other than Armstrong. If you go to university, in any outside source history book, the Persian kings, we have their archives, we have it's all, and we have their year, we have their history, and the Greeks write about them also. Herodotus writes about them. They're well known. Those are the years everyone comes up with. There's Cyrus, which identifies Koresh. Cambyses, which fits into the Atashasta of Teradalahein Vav, about this letter we wrote. Then there's Darius the Great, Ayavesh. Then there's Achashverosh, which we call Xerxes, and then Atashasta. And we're going to see that these kings fit perfect with Tanakh. Better than perfect. It'll be a perfect match with Tanakh. Sederlam doesn't follow this. We'll see what Sederlam does in a minute. But that's what happens in Tanakh. Now, look at the end, and Sefer Ezra, look at the end of Parak Vav. Parak Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Aleph even. We have all this story, and finally the Jews are able to build the Mikdash. Parak Vav Pasuk Yud Aleph. V'shebi Yudei Banin Matzichin V'dvot Hagai Nefiyah V'dvari Benido V'dno V'shichlilu Mitam Eloi Yitro Mitam Koresh V'dayevash V'tashasta Melech Horot. The Jews, under the leadership of Hagai Nefiyah, their inspiration, and according to the original okay of Koresh, way back, and the new okay of Dayevash, and maybe despite the letter of V'tashasta, were finally able to build the house for God. When did they finish building it? Pasuk Vav, the Sheikh did bite the Dinah, Adyom Tav the Dera Hadar, the Ishnat Sheikh, the Lachut the Dayevash Malka. they finished constructing the Mikdash in the sixth year of Dayavesh and the third day of Adar. Timu Adar, year six of Dayavesh, it took about 4 or 5 years to build. From year two of Dayavesh to year six. Then they make Chanukah Tabai. And then we go to Hebrew, the Pasuk Yotzev. You see what happens to Perek Vav? The end of Perek Vav is the Beit HaMikdash is built, and we celebrate. And we make a big Pesach. And that's the end of Perek Vav. What year are we up to? Year 6 of Dayavesh. What's the next event? It's enough. Perek Zayin. V'achar Dvarim Ha'eleh. Just like the Megillah starts. And what happens? The Malchut HaSashashta Melech Horam. As Rebbe Tzai V'chule. Perek Zayin begins in the 7th year of HaSashashta when Ezra makes Aliyah. What does the book skip? It skips from where to where. From year 6 to Dayavish, year 7 of HaSashashta. If you follow the outside history, it works perfect. Because what time period did it skip? It skipped Achashverosh. It works perfect. The names fit, everything fits perfectly. Why did it skip? I suggested already a reason. We'll go back to it in a minute. What's happening in year 7 of HaSashashta? Who makes Aliyah? Ezra comes. I hope you know the story. Ezra comes with his big mouth. He's a sofer mahir b'torat Hashem Elohav. And he wants to come and make Jerusalem from. He hears what's happening in Yerushalayim. He wants to teach Torah in Yerushalayim because it's bad. When he comes, what does he find? He comes to the leaders of the community saying, you're coming here from Brooklyn to teach Torah. And guess what? You're wasting your time. You know why? Look around. What do you have here? We're all assimilated. Everyone's intermarried. There's tons of intermarriage. That's the biggest problem. And who's intermarried? The Sarim and the Kohanim are intermarried. It's a question, who's the Jew? It's a disaster when Ezra comes. Now when Ezra comes, he doesn't meet Haggai, he doesn't meet Zechariah, we don't hear anything about Zerubbabel. There's four big leaders, if you read in the time of Dayavesh. There's Haggai, Zechariah, the Nevi, Yeshua, Kohen Gadol, and Zerubbabel, the leader. When Ezra comes, they're not there. We find that he talks to the grandchildren. We have the genealogies of a lot of them. And there's Al Yeshiva's Kohen Gadol. There's no one from the cast of the year 2 to 6 of Dayavish. All the people in the books of Haggai and Zechariah don't exist when Ezra comes in year 7 of HaSashashta. Despite that, what does Seder Olam do? Seder Olam says, what is year 7 of HaSashashta? Let's jump to the next year. They crunch from year 6 of Dayavish to year 7 of HaSashashta. What do they say? Who is Dayavish or HaSashashta? Which was that really neat, because we go year six, year seven. There's circumstantial evidence. And we're still good. It's too good to be true. Now, if you read the books, it's so clear it can't be. How could Ezra come? First of all, when the Goyim wanted to join the building project, what did the Jews say? Goyim, Seth. What do we find now? Tons of intermarriage. How could that be? If you read the story of the intermarriage, the second, third generation intermarriage, it's like, you know, from Europe to, like, from the early 1900s to the late 1960s and 70s. It's a second, third generation phenomenon, with Ezra finds. And Ezra's coming as a reformer. And why didn't Ezra make Aliyah before this, if he was so religious? Why didn't he come with Haggai and Zechariah? It makes much more sense if I follow the outside history. When did Ezra come? Several decades later, 56 years later, he came. And there's no, and all the details in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah fit it perfectly with the outside history. What does Seder Olam come to do? Crunches it all up. What I'm suggesting why, there's two. One is, if the book of Ezra and Nehemiah crunches it, Seder Olam is going to crunch it. Number two, what else is the game? 1K. The booby, that's the booby part. What's the, that's the booby part. The byproduct. The other thing we gain by all this is we turn Minyan Shtarot into a Jewish year. Which is even easier, yeah.
How do you understand the word characterology? What you say in Bob's line, we refer to Achashverosh or Achashverosh before the resolution of the book.
We'll start again? Perek Vav?
Perek Vav, Perek
Vav, Perek Vav, now you doubt you're trying. During the brain of Achashverosh, they wrote a hate letter about Yerushalayim.
The actual history of the resolution of the book.
It was built already, for sure.
So Ezra's out of order. This Sukkot is out of order.
Why? It's perfect. We go from Korsh to Dayavish. There's a stop. In Dayavish we build. In the time of Achashverosh, there's problems again. He didn't stop the building. They wrote a hate letter about the Jews. Now, if that's Achashverosh is a Megillah, that's true, isn't it? They write a hate letter about the Jews.
Those
took them
written before the successful building of
the Jews. No, because it's coming as an appendix. When we go to Aramaic, it's an appendix. And that input about Ahasuerus is an insert, which is cryptic no matter what. Now, if what we're saying is true, it's really neat. Because when did the story of the Megillah take place? Right in the gap. That's what's so cool about it. The gap in the book of Ezra, between the 6 years of Dayavish to the 7 years of Rathashastra, between Haggai and Zechariah and Ezra, what is that gap in Jewish history? That's Megillat Esther. And when do we find Megillat Esther? Yishno Amacham, Vodar Pek Ben Amin, Vodatem Melech Hinam Shomim. Lo Shevel Melech Hanicham. And that's the whole Megillah share, I think I've done it before, where it could be that one of the messages of the Megillah is not only coming to explain to us why God saved and how God saved the Jewish people, it's also coming to explain why God almost destroyed us and why we deserve it to be destroyed. And if you ever read Shira Tazino in its introduction in Parsha Vayera, you understand why it's called Esther, or the better Esther, the Esther Minayim, that's the real one. Or the Esther Panayim. Esther Panayim is not a reason, it's not telling us how God saves us. Esther Panayim is explaining how God, how and why God punishes us. When we break His covenant, we're a nation, God called upon His nation to return, to show off His beauty to all the nations. God called upon His wife to show off her beauty to all the nations by coming to Yerushalayim to make the Midah. And what's the wife decide to do? Doesn't want to come. Story sounds familiar?
Vashti.
Okay. That's the whole Megillah shir. I might be hitting you to something. But if we've identified that Ahasuerus is the Megillah, that was the title of the shir. And we took some time to get to the title. The title of the shir is exactly that. If you want to understand Ahasuerus of the Megillah, you have to understand Ahasuerus of the Book of Ezra Nehemiah. Because it's exactly the time period of in between that they don't purposely skip. Where the Jews, the Beit HaMikdash was built. Read Zechariah. Again, that's the whole, just read Zechariah. Zechariah is begging the people. God says, just like I went out of my way to punish you, I'm going out of my way to help you. Just come back and represent me properly. He's not saying just make Aliyah, he's saying also do Tzedakum Mishpat. And that's the Divrei Shalom Darnet. I think we said that here before. Mm-hmm. The Divrei Shalom Darnet? Yes, I think it's an old one.
Mm-hmm.
That's written up, but see, the mitzvot of Purim, mitzvot Mon Yisrael, Matan Lev Yomim, relates to the mitzvot of Zechariah beautifully. The same words, the same idea, the same thing. Because it's not just about returning and making Aliyah, it's how the Jewish nation is going to act to either be worthy of God bringing them back, or how they have to act once God does bring them back. But to represent God, we have to also improve our behavior. But that's the whole message in Zechariah inside. But what I'm trying to show you now, is if I want to identify who's Ahasuerus from Megillat Esther, and I follow the book of Ezra Nehemiah, I have a perfect match. And in fact, to really appreciate what's going on in the book of Ezra and the book of Megillat Esther, I need this background from Ezra Nehemiah. Now, the rest of the time I want to spend, I'm going to give you some sources to show you how everything fits in, outside in. First, let me explain what Seder Olam does. Seder Olam has an anchor. His anchor is as follows. That's the page I gave you with the missing gears. The one that's computerized, this one. I'm quoting from the book of Daniel. Daniel's Nebuah takes place in the end of the Babylonian time period and the very beginning of the Persian time period. He's with the last Babylonian king, with Belshazzar, all that stuff. And then he's also around in the time of Koresh, and also there's a king named Dayavish Hamadi, the son of another Ahasuerus. Not Ahasuerus, another Dayavish. And Perek Yud. I'm sorry, it's right here. This is Tarek Yudalov, I think. This is Tarek Yudalov. It's Tarek Yudalov. Darius the Mede, that's Darius the Great, the person. Darius the Mede is before Koresh. Koresh takes, he's just king for around a year or so, over the Medes, and later Koresh takes over Prasimadai. In the first year, Darius the Mede, right after, as the Babylonians are falling, and right before Koresh comes in, he has a dream. Pasuk Bet there. If you're a novice in interpreting dreams, who is he talking about? Who's this Melech Yavan who's going to be great and take over everything? Anyone who reads this just right away, just say Alexander the Great. Because his kingdom breaks into three different parts afterwards, and the Melech Negev is Tamah in Egypt. And when you read this in a novice, what do you say? This has to be Alexander the Great. If this is Alexander the Great, I only have three Persian kings to fit in. So who are the three Persian kings after Dayavish Hamadi? Oshosha Malachim. I have four candidates. I got Koresh, I got Ahasuerus, I have Dayavish, I have Artashasta. Now, the deal can't be wrong, and this has to be on a standard degree. So what's the interim do? I have four candidates, and I have three physicians. I share one. Who has to be the first king?
Koresh.
Who has to be the last king? Dayavish, because everyone knows Alexander killed Dayavish. But Dayavish is also our Tafshasta. Why? Because it just so happens that year six, Dayavish is one of it, and then year seven, it's the same king. Therefore, they say, who Koresh? Who Dayavish? Who are Tafshasta? And who's the king in between? Ahasuerus, Miguel, and Esther. Do they fit? That's the whole share. They fit perfectly. They fit. There's just enough room for Ahasuerus. Koresh is king for 3 years. Ahasuerus is king for 14 years. Then comes Darius, who's Artashasta, 34 years. And that's the whole Persian time period. That's what Sarah does. We call bingo. It fits so nicely. Now, that doesn't fit in the book of Ezra at all, does it? It doesn't fit in the book of Ezra. It doesn't begin to fit in the book of Ezra. But it fits, but it solves the problem. Now you have a calendar. It also saves this, it also follows thematically the message of the book of Ezra. It also gives us the 1K theory to make me then show in a Jewish year. And therefore, Sederlund is a masterpiece of Parshanut, isn't it? It's a masterpiece of Parshanut. It's tremendous. And it works so nice, and it caught on like wildfire, to the point that everyone began to take it literally. Got it? Now, I don't think Chazal meant to be taken literally. It meant to be taken thematically. But from a Midrashic point of view, what he does with the years is simply a masterpiece. It's great. And everyone accepts it. Now, once you understand that, we've solved a problem with our college students, or maybe ourselves. You understand why? Because don't be surprised if something caught on. Once you take Seder Olam's years, you know how many problems you solve? You have a reason for Ahasuerus with Mitzvah. And you have, oh, now we understand why Jerry built the temple because he's after his son. And everything fits so nicely, and every single year is taken care of. And I have a perfect history, everything works out great. So if I had to teach in young grades, so what everyone wants to know, a calendar, what happened? And the book of Ezra doesn't give me a calendar, but this calculation of Seder Olam turns it into a calendar and solves all my question marks and solves all the gaps. So it caught on and became, but since it's happened to go in, it's been the accepted Jewish history, and that's it. People don't study Ezra Nehemiah with all the dates, etc. And you can, and Ezra Nehemiah is ambiguous enough that it can fit in. If we did enough stretching, it fits in nicely. It's definitely not Shushan Shemikra. But you can definitely take Seder Olam and fit it into the book of Ezra without having anything 100% against it. It can work. And therefore, for the last 1,000 years, if you caught on like wildfire, we use it for the date. The Jewish date is based on that. The Jewish date, 1576 days, is based on 420 years of Beit Sheni and 400 years of Brit Ben Absarim. Because we've been counting ever since Korban HaBayit, based on that Hezbon. And it's become a Jewish Bidah. We write it on our Tzuvot. But we don't say it's not a tentative Jewish faith at that time of year it's been since Briyat HaOlam. No one says that. But it's a minute. It says the minute Shanu Mavim. It's a little caveat there. Maybe Laura can explain how it helps. It's not worth saying this is a statement of truth. Could be 6 million years since then. But the minute Shanu Mavim is 5768. We're not saying that's exactly how many years it's been since Briyat HaOlam. If someone proves you something different, nothing happens. Now it's hard to explain that to little kids. That's why I'm doing it more for adults. I just touched on the main, on the first part. Hope you follow what we did. Now, I have a couple more sheets I'm going to give out to you. Let me just summarize, and I'll give out the sheet that I wanted to do. If you look on, look in Ezra, just one, a couple other things, just to show you, on that sheet I gave you, we have the other dates. But in Parak Zion, in Parak Tet, it talks about this, the four wives. Chok Eila Nikshu Alay Sarin Lemor Lo Nitzu Lam Yisrael Konim Melavim Yamei Hartzot Kutav Ten Lekzanim, etc. Ki Nesu Mitnoteyam Lehem Benet Vemi Tarbu Vidar Kodesh Vyana Sur Mefganim Hayta Bamala Zeb Rishonam. When Ezra comes, they tell him we're all intermarried. And again, he doesn't meet Chagai and Tzarya. He meets a whole new generation of people. And Ezra has this whole gathering. And look in Pasek, and Tarek Yud Pasek Yudhet. In Ezra. Who were some of the people who intermarried? The children of Yeshua ben Yosadak. Who's that? He's the Kohen Gadol who built the second temple in the time of Dayavish. Remember the menorah thing? The Dvar Hashem of Zerubbabel, right before it, the Dvar Hashem of Yeshua? Yeshua ben Yosadak is the Kohen who returned to the time of Dayavish. What's happening now? His children are all intermarried. It can't be the year after Ezra and Nehemiah comes. I mean, it can't be the year after Haggai comes. Yeshua is the Kohen Gadol. He's a sheep. He's a big leader. And they don't want to admit to him. His children and grandchildren are now intermarried? It can be the same ten countries. Not to mention there's a whole genealogy later on. Okay. Years in Nehemiah, that's simply so just year 32 and year 34 I got in. And then look in Perek Nun. In Nehemiah. Perek Yudet, Pasuk Aleph, in Nehemiah. Pasuk Yud. In Nehemiah, Perek Yudet, Pasuk Yud. We get from Yeshua, we get the genealogy, Yeshua Hovedit Yoyakim, Yoyakim Hovedit Yoyashiv. Yoshiv is the Kohen Gadol in Nehemiah. But Yeshiva is Yoyada, Yoyada Hovedit Yonatan, Yoyatan Hovedit Yadua. We have seven generations from Yeshua Ben Yosadak down, including Yoshiv, the Kohen Gadol, his grandson, who seems to be the Kohen Gadol in the time of Nehemiah, and another four generations by the time the book of Ezra is finished. You can't crunch that in 34 years. You follow? It just doesn't fit. And that's what I'm saying, when it was written, everyone knew it was not to be taken seriously. But it came out so good. Remember, we turn the voice into something good. And it follows the theme of the book of Ezra. And then it catches on. And the only question I'm left with is, how did it catch on, and how did everyone not... How could it be that so many people accepted Sarah Lama's face value and took it literally and didn't pay attention to Ezra Nehemiah? My answer is simply, look in Yeshiva World today. The book's in every hotel room. And you could read it and figure it out, but no one looks at it, no one reads it. Because it's Yisrael Torah. So that's the... Now, I'm going to give you a couple of things because I made a lot of copies. First, I have a copy of Seder Olam, which has all the calculation in it. If you want to see Seder Olam, here's that we're talking about. There are all the calculations are in here. So I'm going to leave them out on the front here. And you can grab them. But another thing I want to show you, which is the two... Each one's its own chair. These are all the years of the, based on the real history, or called the accepted history, and stuff like that. Koresh, Kambiti, Zayabesh, Ahasuerus, Atashatta. There's a map of all the years when everything's taking place. On the flip side is all the years of Seder Olam. The Koresh is it together, and the Hezra two sets of 7 years. We did that year before. I had some extra pages around. So I'll leave those out for you to take. What we have left to do, again, there's a lot more behind it. The main point I want to get across is if I understand the setting, I'm trying to understand what leads Seder Olam to this conclusion. And once you understand Seder Olam is Parshanut and Midrash, and there's a goal to this Midrash, there's a goal to crunching the years. There's a thematic goal, a prophetic goal, and a big gain of turning Seder Olam into a Jewish year. Those goals are enough to come up with it. He did such a good job that everyone began taking it literally. And once we take it literally, that's been our Jewish custom for 1,000 years, and therefore there's nothing wrong with writing the Jewish date that way. Because we're not making a statement of faith. What's interesting though, and the coolest thing is, if it's true, then we're very close to the year 6,000. Okay. Yeah, we're about 106 years closer to the year 6,000. I don't know that. You guys think anyone who's trying to buy real estate anywhere. Before there'd be a big real estate crisis, like, we never stop next week. No, with all that stuff. But you learn your history classes, about Jewish history, you'll find those. Okay, so I'll leave these out. I have to run because I think it's here in Englewood.
Oh, no.
And thank you again for the past
discussion. I'm going there.
Thank you. But if they're in the box, there's much greater chance to survive.
This one doesn't have a tail. It must be the 19th that you were missing.
Oh, I would count the 20. I count the 20 originally.
Okay. Well, whatever. There's one that doesn't
have a tail. 9.
No, this is
5, 10.
17. We're missing
16. That's 16.
Do you need help with something?
That's psychiatric.
It's 18.
That's 18. We're still missing two. Is the other box?
This morning was 19. I put out the box. So that's the straight arrow on the box. We're missing one from this morning.
I wonder if it's familiar with Rabbi Schwab's article.
What?
I wonder if it's familiar with Rabbi Schwab's article.
Here's one.
Oh, there it is. That's
okay.
No, that's still 19. That's 20.
No, but we didn't have 20. We had 19.
Okay, but we're still like, we had 20 when you bought it. Maybe here's the one.
Bird body. I don't care what he doesn't like to resolve it. I think it's a beautiful print, and I love the story. I brought it up first, I love it. Yeah. So, I mean, look here, like, jump it off. This is Kirkland. Are you
familiar with it? Yeah, it starts, begins, and everybody
in the
world. Rabbi Schwab, especially for who he is.
Yeah.
I wrote this article back in the 70s about 2,666 years.
Right.
It is too, to say the least, strange.
According to
the Chazal,
yes, in my notebook, which was I was sitting here.
That goes first cabinet, fourth shelf, fifth shelf. See the gap?